I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. He's the author and illustrator of the Olivia children's book series about a pig inspired by his niece, also named Olivia. The first Olivia, published in 2000, won the Caldecott Award, among other accolades. Ian is a set and costume designer for opera and dance, and he's created numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. Welcome.
Thank you.
Could you describe what your home looks like in New York City, in the West Village?
Did you ever read... which is the book? Is it Our Mutual Friend? It's the one with Jarndyce, and there's the Rag and Bone Man shop with all this... just everything is stacked to the ceilings, books piled up 4 feet high. It's a mess. It's a complete mess. And I work in there and live in there and entertain in there. It's a wonderful 1950s. I think they were built as kind of bachelor pads in the 50s. Very, very streamlined. It's a staircase that comes down with a wraparound balustrade. But it's all buried now. It's very clean lines, but it's all completely buried. I don't know what this is. It's like living in a boat in New York. I have to have paper and paints and a lot of materials and a lot of reference books, and I have tons of music and tons of CDs, DVDs.
When you say that you also entertain in there, do you feel the inclination to clean up before your guests come? What kind of entertaining do you do in there?
Not much anymore, but I used to actually have... I have a grand piano in the living room, and I used to have concerts. Friends would come over and perform, and we'd invite maybe 30, 40, 50 people. There's actually no room to do that anymore. The neighbors complain, too.
You worked on Olivia in your bedroom on an easel, and there's a quote you once said.
Yes, I had a one room studio apartment at that point, so there was nothing but the bed.
Yeah, and you said at one point, I nearly had a nervous breakdown. I'd go to bed staring at the work, then wake up with it.
Yes, you need a lot of floor space. People are always saying, why don't you get a dog? Paper, floor, dog. No.
What is your ideal workspace?
Ideally, I would like to have a whole townhouse where I could have office space in the basement and then two floors to live on and two floors to work on.
Hmm.
And separate space for doing sculpture and stuff like that. Hmm. And theater design, which is really messy, and other space for painting and drawing. So
somehow I think you might fill that space with
I would. I think it, I, you know.
What is your work habit? Are you working during the day?
Yeah, I tend to work a lot at night. Start about 5 in the evening and then work till 4 in the morning or something. It's the only time the phone doesn't ring. It's quiet.
What time did you wake up this morning?
9:30. Well, I didn't get to sleep until 7, so...
Until 7 a.m.
So you... I have a trouble getting to sleep when I know I have to do something the next day.
Yes.
Like get on a plane or go to the dentist or be interviewed on... At least it's not live.
And do you find that the public part of your work like a distraction?
Oh, absolutely. I find it an absolute pain in the neck. Very distracting. Yeah, I can't do anything else. Well, they were really smart. Nobody told me about it. Nobody reminded me about this until last night. So I didn't have 3 days to go sweat.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. You are an artist in various mediums. You do costume and set design. You've been the author and illustrator for Olivia. You create New Yorker magazine covers. When you were younger and you had aspirations to be an artist, did you have a vision of, you know, one of those vehicles for expressing your art?
I always liked doing lots of different things. My father was a wonderful amateur carpenter. He could build anything, shelves, cabinetry. He was an architect. And he had a great shop, which he let me play in all the time. So I learned very early how to make things. And I don't know what my mother must have thought. Me, a 6-year-old kid using a radial arm saw is a little terrifying. Drill presses and a lathe. We had a lathe. It could turn candlesticks and things. Really dangerous. Essentially, you know, we say, oh, he does theater and draws and paints. But essentially, that's much the same thing. It's all involves drawing.
You grew up in Richfield, Connecticut, right? Ridgewood?
No, I was born in Richfield, but I was actually moved from there when I was about 4. We moved to an island off the coast of Connecticut in Long Island Sound, just half a mile offshore. It was absolutely idyllic, very beautiful. It's called Tavern Island. It's just our house, one house.
And how did your family come to live on an island, and how did you end up being the only family on that island, or the only house on that island?
It was an old house. It's a turn-of-the-century house, and we'd always sailed around it, and my parents saw it came up for sale. It used to be owned by Billy Rose, the great Broadway impresario, and it was very silly. It had Italian sculptures of muses and putti, little babies and things all over it, and peacocks, and huge amount of animals. We had a huge amount of animals, which may be why I'm so good at anthropomorphizing my pig. We had at one point 18 peacocks, 4 guinea fowl, ringneck pheasants, golden pheasants, birds, and because we'd feed them, we also got all the neighborhood ducks and geese that would come and just plop themselves on the lawn. And then there were all the abandoned ducklings that we got re-raised. And there was, at one point, my sister had found 5 ducklings that were with no mother, and they printed on her and would follow her around in a little train like ducklings do, and it was so adorable. We had this circle of chicken wire that we put on the beach in the water so they could swim without escaping and be protected from other creatures, and one of them got caught, its head got caught, and the tide was coming in, and it was not breathing, and I held its bill closed and I gave it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and it lived. My sister thought I was a hero from then on.
It sounds idyllic and great material for your work. Did your parents make a conscious decision to give you, this eclectic way of life? Or was it just, of course, this is what we're going to do, is have 18 peacocks?
Well, they were there on the island when we got it.
You grew up there with your 2 sisters, Tonya and Victoria, as well as your parents. Your father was a carpenter and architect. And what did your mother do?
She actually taught art sometimes, and she ran a sailing school, and we were always involved with boats, so that's, I suppose, why we ended up on an island.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. In addition to creating the book series, he's designed sets and costumes for the New York City Ballet, the San Francisco Opera, the Royal Opera House in London, and the Théâtre du Châtelet in Paris. Ian also creates covers for the New Yorker magazine. So fast forward, was there any question that you would do anything else with your life other than make art?
Well, my parents didn't like the idea that much because it's hard to make a living as an artist. So I was sent to NYU and I did art history and then flunked out after 2 years because I really didn't want to be an art historian at all. Then I went to Parsons.
In New York City?
Yeah.
Can you talk to me some more about the early period when you were at NYU having a difficult moment in your life when you were studying art history and all you wanted to do was make art? Like, what was the what was the 18-year-old Ian Falconer like?
Well, I would still make things, even though I wasn't in an art school. But as my father said, well, he's majoring in Studio 45. Intentionally getting it wrong. I was a wild 18-year-old, yeah. I got to New York from a boarding school in Massachusetts, believe me.
All right, so you were majoring in Studio 54.
It was really, really fun. It was a time in New York when the uptown people and the downtown people all mixed together in a different way. And now the downtown people all live in Brooklyn separate. And it was a much more vibrant, wild city than it is now. And it was amazing looking around a room and seeing, well, there's Frank Perdue, and there's Martha Graham, and there's Barbara Streisand, and there's Liza Minnelli, and there's everybody was there. Everybody was doing cocaine at that time, from museum directors, socialites, not just kids. It was everybody passing around little vials at dinner parties and things. No food got eaten.
Did drugs fuel your creativity even at that time?
No. It's a waste of time.
Okay, so during this time, after leaving NYU, you went to Parsons Art School in New York City.
Yeah, and I met a lot of people in the art world, and through one of them, Henry Geldzahler, who used to be the Commissioner of Cultural Affairs, I met David Hockney. He said he offered me work out in Los Angeles, and they have a sister school, Parsons Otis Art Institute, in Los Angeles. So I transferred out there and worked for him for about 13 years.
Now, David Hockney, the artist.
The artist, yes.
Was also, he was creating sets.
He was doing, yeah.
For theater and opera in Los Angeles.
Yes, that's what I was working with him on. So I got really good training through that. In the studio and in the theater.
And you collaborated with David professionally, and you also were his boyfriend for a few years. Is that mm-hmm. is that right?
At the beginning, yeah.
How long were you partners as well?
Oh, I don't know. Does it ever really end? I'm still in touch with him all the time, and I love him dearly.
Describe that experience for me of creating and set designing.
Well, music has always been very important to me. So working on the operas and the ballet was... Ballet, not so much, but the opera is thrilling. Learning from David, he would always say, if you're stuck for an idea, listen to the music, love. Listen to the music. And he always take it back to the music, which a lot of designers don't.
Would you listen to the music as you were designing to give you inspiration?
Can mm-hmm. you? Over and over again. Every available recording we could find of the thing we would play.
What's an example of one of the projects you worked on with him?
Tristan and Isolde, mm-hmm. Turandot, which is still in circulation, plays a lot. Die Frau in Schatten, which is a Strauss opera.
So David was a real mentor. What are some things that he taught you, whether it's about the world of art or
Well, he's
the
very
work.
Passionate about art, so yes, I learned a lot about painting. But technically, as he says, it's that an art school can't teach you art. It can only teach you how to use a pencil and a brush and oil paints. And it can only teach you techniques, really. It's up to you to make the art. He draws constantly, all the time. They're always interesting, and he's tireless.
In a way, creating sets for opera or ballet is very three-dimensional, and a lot of your work, though, has also been, on the page. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that?
I tend to do painted drop sets, so they're layers of illusionistic painting and not built sets. One reason is because when you build a set, you tend to be stuck with that set, whereas when you have drop sets, you can change it instantly, and you can have many, many, many different scene changes, which people love.
And in a way, it's more of connective tissue to the books and the magazines because it's a little more two-dimensional mm-hmm. in a way.
Mm. But you can get some great three-dimensional illusions that way. Forcing perspective and all that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. We'll hear more from Ian coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. He's the author and illustrator of the Olivia children's book series about a pig inspired by his niece, also named Olivia. The first Olivia, published in 2000, won the Caldecott Award, among other accolades. Ian is a set and costume designer for opera and dance, and he's created numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. So moving forward from your life in Los Angeles, designing sets with David Hockney, to New York, where you created Olivia in your Greenwich Village apartment, what was the impetus for moving back to New York City?
My lease was up in Los Angeles, and I thought, do I want to move to another house here? Or I was actually only going to spend maybe 6 months back in New York. My family's all here, so I thought it'd be nice, and I ended up staying.
Were you feeling, satisfied professionally, or were you feeling like, I have a book in me, or what was your...
I was actually a bit at a loss because I had a gallery in Los Angeles, but I didn't have a gallery in New York, and my paintings were not fashionable at that time.
What did they look like?
I do portraits and landscapes and interiors and still lifes. Having worked with David Hockney all those years, I'd known art dealers for a long time, and they're a funny breed. I remember going to Robert Miller Gallery, I think, and it was his assistant at that point who saw me, and he didn't like my stuff, and so he suggested that I go to another gallery that handled Peter Schlesinger, one of David Hockney's old boyfriends. Mm. And I thought that was the worst put down. Go to David's ex-boyfriend gallery. I wasn't quite sure what to do, and I thought, well, I've got to make some money. So I thought, well, I'll send in some things to the New Yorker magazine and amazingly, they liked my work, which is a dream for an illustrator. Any illustrator would like that job.
Did you have any connections at the New Yorker, or you just pretty much put your material in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and sent it in?
I had a friend who knew somebody who knew a guy named David Kuhn who worked with Tina Brown.
Who was the former editor.
And I came and gave them to him. He didn't seem very impressed with them, and I think he didn't want to get me to get my hopes up or anything. But so all I can do is show them to the editor, and my editor, Françoise Mouly, who's wonderful. I didn't hear anything from them, and I finally thought, well, I'll write a note and just say I haven't gotten my drawings back. If you have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them. Mm-hmm. And this is my phone number. And the next day, she called me up and said, "Oh, darling, hello. I do want you to come up and see my office, see what's on the wall." They didn't use any of the drawings I sent them, but it took me almost a year to get my first cover, but I. It did support me. They were very generous at that time. They used to buy in things even if they didn't use them. And it was while I was doing that, Olivia was born. And she was the first kid in the family.
Now, this was in 1996, and you were in your mid to late 30s when the New Yorker picked you up. What was the first cover that you did for the New Yorker?
It was 4th of July, and it was an image of the arm of the Statue of Liberty, and she's holding a sparkler instead of a torch. Not the best joke in the world, but it was a nice visual.
The New Yorker paid you up front each year so that it mm-hmm. freed you up to not only create for the New Yorker, but to work on various other projects, including Olivia.
And theater, yeah. And I started doing Olivia so I would have more time to paint. But as I've lived in New York, every year it's gotten so much more expensive over the last 15 years. That I kept having to do more books.
Right.
I was trying to buy a studio at one point, and then the housing market all fell apart. So eventually, I think the next book might be called Olivia Pays the Rent.
The inspiration for Olivia, the book series, is your niece, Olivia Crane, mm-hmm. who lives in Connecticut. When did you first think to create a gift for your niece? Because it was a gift initially, right?
Yes. I started drawing this little character and putting it together, and I realized that it was actually pretty good, really funny. The character was very funny, and I took it into William Morris Agency. They had a children's book department. The woman there said, "I like it. I like the drawings, but it's not an Eloise yet. It's not an Eloise." And okay, she said, "Well, we'll hook you up with another. It's your first time author. You'll never get published without. I'll put you together with an established author." And no, I don't want it to be illustrated by Ian Falcon. I've created this character, so I took it home and put it away. And then I got a call from somebody at Simon & Schuster, from Ann Schwartz, who'd seen my New Yorker stuff, and said, "Would you like to illustrate a children's book?" And I said, "Here you go." I brought her the illustration. She loved it, absolutely loved it. That was it.
Describe to me how you felt when you got that call. These are momentous pivot points in your life, whether it was the New Yorker saying, "Yeah, come on in," or Anne saying, "I love the work."
Get very, very, very shy about showing my work. So I remember going up there absolutely terrified. Not terrified, but shaky and nervous. And Anne said, "We were actually really worried about you when we first saw you. We thought, who is this creature that we're getting involved with here?"
You mean when they saw you for the first time?
Yeah.
In person, why? How would you describe what you're like in person?
I tend to get sort of shaky and jittery, nervous, very nervous. You're making me nervous right now. Just talking about it is making me nervous. It was great, but I didn't have that high hopes for it, even when they said yes, because thousands of children's books come out every year, and many of them just go under the radar. They don't get noticed. They were terrific, Simon & Schuster. They put a lot of advertising behind it, and it became very popular. And the Caldecott, of course. That was very funny because they called me at, I think, about 8 o'clock in the morning. I was in a deep slumber, and they said, "Guess what? You've won the Caldecott medal." And I was like, "Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you." I don't think it even really occurred to me what the Caldecott was and how important it was. I soon found out when some of my children's book writing friends started steaming about it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. How would you describe who Olivia is? What's her personality?
She's confident, very confident. Seems to know what she wants. She's contrarian, so just when you think you know what she's going to do next, she'll surprise you by doing the opposite. She wants to do everything herself. She wants to make everything herself. She has a strong imagination.
You mentioned that you had a lot of animals around the house, which is why you might be good at anthropomorphizing in your work. Did you ever think Olivia, the pig, might be a different animal? How did pig come to mind?
Olivia has this very turned-up little nose. And when she was a little kid, you know, little kids, their heads are always a little bit too big for their bodies, and she just looked like a little piglet. Pigs are also very intelligent. Considering they only have trotters, apparently they can get into any cabinet or anything. They're very clever.
The palette for Olivia is spare. There's sort of an economy in the colors that you use.
I think too much color, too much detail, too much stuff distracts from the story. I think that the simplicity of the way Olivia is drawn allows you to see, really concentrate on her facial expressions, which I work very hard on her facial expressions to get it. It's just a tiny little dot for the eye, but you have to get it right, and you end up erasing it over and over and over again, and just to get the right surprise or whatever the look is on her face. I have a sort of technique that I developed for these books. People always think that they're airbrushed, but they're not. I get those women's makeup tools, you know, those cotton balls and cotton swabs and things to do the shadowing, to give this delicate, soft shadowing, and then outline it with charcoal. Then you paint on the gouache, and then you can shade the gouache with the charcoal as well to get that three-dimensional quality. And then the shadow underneath her feet so that she seems to stand on a plane on the floor.
You use the same economy, not just in the palette, but in the language. The words are so simpatico with the art.
I found when I'm working on other illustrating things for other people that I don't have that same feeling of the organic whole of doing the books myself and writing them. And when you're working on the books with the editor at the stage where you've got all the drawings and you're working with the text, you'll keep changing the text and altering things, which if you're with an author, sometimes they never even meet these authors and illustrators, and you wonder, what the hell? Collaborate. A lot of people have trouble collaborating. That's the great thing about theater, is you learn how to collaborate with other people. You have to work with them, or or else.
Who are some children's authors or illustrators whom you're particularly fond of? Or whom you think about as reference points for you?
I love Maurice Sendak, of course. He's truly a giant. His book, and oddly enough, a lot of people don't like it as much as his other books, but is Higgledy Piggledy Pop, if you've ever read it. First of all, it's all in black and white. It's all, I think, pencil or charcoal, graphite or charcoal, I'm not sure. And it's a wonderfully dark tale for children, surreal dark tale for children. Mm-hmm. Dr. Seuss, absolutely. And again, those old two-color printing processes that they used to use, a lot of the early Dr. Seuss books, it's only one color and black and white because it was cheaper. It was very expensive to do a four-color lithograph at that time. Mm-hmm. It's not now. In fact, Olivia's black and white drawings are all done in four-color, five-color, I think it is, so that to get the richness in the charcoal, because charcoal has a lovely warmth to it.
Does the stripe of her sweater at all reference the stripe of the Cat in the Hat, the cat's hat?
No. First of all, stripes delineate the shape of the body wonderfully. They show bulges and all the curves and shapes in the body. But I always liked stripes, whether they're fisherman's stripes, fisherman's shirts, and things like that.
We talk about David Hockney as being an important figure in your life. What other artists have had an impact on you?
Not many living artists that I can think of right now. Certainly, I've been influenced by the large figures of the 20th century, Picasso and Matisse. And, well, I don't know how you could not be influenced by Picasso. And he had this extraordinary facility from a very early age, which allowed him to do anything, pretty much anything he wanted. He could paint like a 50-year-old man when he was 10, His father was a painter and painted little pictures for tourists of pigeons, doves. And Picasso, I don't know, 3 years old or something, copied one of his father's paintings and did it so well that his father just put down his brushes and said, "You do it now."
You mentioned Picasso and Matisse, I think of as an explosion of color.
No, very controlled, though. It's very hard to use color, and he does it beautifully. So does Hockney.
Even though Olivia is not soaked in color.
It reads as color, though. It doesn't read as, to me, it doesn't read as a black and white book. The first book does have just one color. The second book has a cup, like red and pink. And the third book has green and red, but it's tightly controlled.
There's also an appeal for adults in Olivia. And some say that it was an instant success because parents liked Olivia. For instance, there's references to Maria Callas and, of course, Degas and Jackson Pollock in the first Olivia, and later Eleanor Roosevelt. And to what extent are you kind of winking at parents concurrently while you're also trying to appeal to the little people?
There are a couple things. What is the parents frequently have to read these books over and over and over again because kids love repetition. They love being able to anticipate. They know what's coming next. The other thing is, I think when the child and the parent are bonding together reading, it really helps if the parent laughs, because children will laugh at what their parents will. And they'll also try and figure out what their parents are laughing at. I think it helps.
You created this initially as a gift for your niece, Olivia, and obviously it's become much larger than that. To what extent has your family gotten involved in this?
My niece, it's very funny. Olivia never, she just took it all, I guess as children do, she just took it all in stride. Of course, there's a book about me. Mm-hmm. she used to autograph them for kids at school. In fact, I was doing a book signing once when she was the first book, and she was very little. And she came up and just, without being asked, sat down next to me and started just signing in a big, slow, O-L-I. And there are people lined up for, 300 people deep back there waiting, and Olivia's just... It's very cute.
I could see for other families who may not want to have a public presence, you have made them public in a way that maybe they might not have expected.
But I don't think many people outside of her school or her friend circle know that she's that Olivia. Town library, maybe.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a pig. The series exists in almost 30 languages, and Olivia debuted in 2009 on Nickelodeon as a TV series. Ian has also designed sets and costumes for various opera and ballet companies, and he's worked in collaboration with the essayist David Sedaris on a stage version of Santaland Diaries, among other projects. I want to talk about Tom Ford for a minute. He's a fashion designer, and he's also the director of the movie A Single Man by Isherwood. You were partners with Tom Ford.
Yeah, we met at NYU. We were in the same class at NYU.
One of the reasons I bring him up is in his movie, the lead character is a gentleman, George, and George's last name in the movie is Falconer. You being somebody kind of private have been the object. You've been now on the other side, in a way, by being George Falconer. You are Falconer.
Yes, there's no last name in the book, so he needed to invent one for the screen, and that was very sweet of him, very, very sweet of him.
What role did he play in your life? I assume, are you still friends? And
yes.
You both obviously met each other at a very formative stage, both very young at NYU. How do you think you have influenced each other's lives or careers, if at all?
I don't know. I'm not sure we have that much. He's been a wonderful friend, but we're very different people.
You're both in the milieu of meeting other artists and...
But he's always immaculate and put together, and his house is absolutely pristine, clean, crisp. And I'm a slob and messy. He's very social. I'm not. Cares what he looks like. I don't. I have 6 white Brooks Brothers shirts and 6 pairs of blue jeans, and that's makes it so much easier.
Incidentally, there are a number of children's books created by single men who don't have children. Maurice Sendak comes to mind.
Yes.
Where the wild things are. Do you think it's just coincidence or you know, talk to me about that. You don't have children.
No. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That is an odd thing. I hadn't thought of that. I think possibly that single middle-aged men have never grown up themselves and maintain a kind of attachment to childhood that other people may not have when they've married or saddled with children, and they also may not have time to the luxury of time to sit and think and draw and diddle and doodle. I used to have a macrobiotic teacher in California during one of my California health things, and she always said that gay men have made some subconscious decision not to take responsibility. And I bristle at that, but more I think maybe she's a little bit right there. They tend to postpone adolescence into their 50s.
You mentioned macrobiotics. Are you focused on eating well? And
I try, but it's not that easy in New York City. Maybe it's my neighborhood.
The West Village.
The West Village. Tends to be either high-end or pizza.
Ernest Hemingway says, he talks about doing the best work on an empty stomach.
Like, yeah, I often don't eat until dinner. Mm-hmm. Keeps you sharper. Yeah, it does.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been the artist Ian Falconer. Coming up, we'll meet Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital invitations. Users can choose all the design elements of a card, ranging from font to color, pattern, size, and Paperless Post has delivered more than 60 million invitations and cards since its inception in 2009. Alexa started the company when she was 23 years old with her younger brother, James. Welcome.
Thank you.
How would you describe what Paperless Post is?
Paperless Post it's a website that you go to, and you can design anything that you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, except that you send it all online. Once you've designed it, you put in your recipients' names and email addresses. When you send it to them, they receive it in their inbox, and you can track their RSVPs. And I think the key difference between us and other online invitation companies is that it really looks like what you'd buy in a brick-and-mortar stationery store, from the texture of the paper stock that the invitation appears to be printed on to the envelope with the receiver's name on it that shows up in their inbox and the animation for the more formal cards.
You co-founded the company with your brother, James. How did the idea for the company originate?
It was the result of a series of conversations that James and I had about various things that we wanted to do together. In the beginning, it was that we wanted to work together on a movie, on a film, so he would be the director and I would be the writer and producer. And then I had an idea for another company where it also involved the internet and a mass customization tool where people would design their own suits, and they would get made in Vietnam and in Hoi An and then get sent to the U.S., Neither one of those panned out, but we kept talking, and James called me one day and had this idea. He said, you know, I think that if this were available, people would use it, and I think that they'd probably pay for it, too. I remember responding and saying, I think that you're right that people would use it. I don't know whether they'd pay for it, but I think that we should do it.
Your brother was at Harvard, where you also had graduated from. Do you know how he came up with this idea at the time?
He was actually planning a birthday party for himself. It was his 21st birthday. He'd ordered palm trees, little mini palm trees for $5 each, and printed cups that said Beach Club. You know, it was in the middle of winter, but it said Beach Club on them. But then when it came around to actually inviting people to the party, he really didn't have very many options because it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks away, and he didn't have people's home addresses, and he didn't really have enough money to spend on printing invitations. But at the same time, he didn't want to use Evite or email, which wouldn't express how cool he knew the party would be. So it was actually out of his own experience that he came up with the idea of paperless post.
What were you doing at the time that also was leading you in the direction of wanting to start an online business?
There are a lot of other thoughts that went into doing this kind of company. One of them was that I was working at an older media company, and I was noticing the difficulties that they were having monetizing their content online. It seemed like a really, really big, scary thing for a lot of people and an opportunity for young people who were looking for an opportunity to be creative and solve a problem that the world needed.
You mentioned you had been working for a traditional older media company. That's CBS. You were Katie Kirk's assistant.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
I had worked with her at the Olympics in Athens in 2004. And the reason I got that job was because I speak Greek and read and write Greek because my mom's family is Greek American. So it was all very roundabout how I ended up there.
And when you were at CBS, you did receive a lot of invitations in the mail. Did that influence your thinking that, you know what, maybe this could work?
We did receive a lot of invitations at CBS for Katie. But one of the interesting things was that if people were trying to follow up, they would always do it by email. So it meant that essentially for any invitation, there also had to be a digital version. So all of a sudden, it seemed as though the print version was sort of a formality.
Your brother was very specific about his idea, and he is somewhat of an artist. What is his background in the artistic area?
He's entirely self-taught in terms of visual design and graphic design. His entire life, he's been practicing art. So he was a photographer, he was a painter, coin collector, stamp collector, sculptor. And I remember seeing other people's reaction to the things that he would make. And it would be things that he would make in his room. But I remember seeing my mother's friends at our house and always having the same kind of reaction, being impressed. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I also thought about when he was telling me about this idea.
Your mom is from Greece.
From Greece via Pennsylvania.
Okay. And how about your father?
My father's from New York City.
What did your parents do? What do your parents do?
My parents are both lawyers. Mm-hmm. And my dad now practices real estate. And my mom is actually a in-house counsel at Paperless Post.
You mentioned that your mom is Greek and that you speak Greek. Do you speak any other languages?
Yeah, languages were the thing that I was that made me most interested in school initially. So I speak and read and write modern Greek, and I speak Spanish, and I also know Latin and ancient Greek as well from school.
How do you think that's informed any of this?
I think it's informed a lot of it because I am really interested in the programming languages that we use, and I've learned enough about each of them to understand what I need to know about how they're used, and that makes my job really fun.
When you say programming languages, you're talking about computer programming languages, the plumbing that goes on behind what you see.
That's right. It's what makes it all work.
Because ultimately, it seems like, as well as being a design-oriented company, Paperless Post is a technology company.
Yeah, and more of that, half the people that work at Paperless Post are software developers.
You were 23 years old when you launched the company, and your brother was 21. How did that help or hurt?
So somebody told us once that one of the things you learn when you start a company is that everything that you think is going to be easy is really hard and takes a really long time, and everything that you think is going to be hard is really hard and takes a really long time. And one of the benefits to being a really young person with very little experience when you start a company is that you really do not have much fear about what's going to go into it, and you have the energy to stay up all night, and you have the fearlessness to write somebody that's more senior than you and ask them to work at your company.
Who was one of the people you wrote letters to, senior executives?
I think it wasn't as much senior executives. Mm-hmm. It was more people that knew things that we didn't know, like very, very good software developers. There's a very important technical culture at our company, and that was really founded and cultivated by Aaron Quint, who is our CTO. And in the beginning, he contracted with Paperless Post, and he really wasn't going to come on and work full-time because he had a really great career contracting. And so hiring people that were really different from us and not being scared to ask them to come work with us, and the fact that we were all young, he's also my age, was definitely a benefit in terms of building the company.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that enables users to email custom-made stationery that wouldn't typically be sent over the internet. Users range from individuals to institutions like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the National Gallery. So you had this moment where you thought, okay, we're gonna give this a try. Your brother was still in college, and you were still working as Katie Couric's assistant. What happened then?
What happened was that it was a process of working backwards from the end product that James had defined, the unit of which was a card that was customized. We worked backwards to understand how you would have that be sent over the internet. We quickly realized that it would be via a design process that a user would be in control of, which meant that we needed to create a tool online that would enable a user to create that end product. On nights and weekends, we would meet with a lot of different people, and we would also spend a lot of alone time in our parents' house, or when he was at school and I was living at my parents' house, laying out and designing what we could do. And for him, that was the card and the cards and the format of the end product. And for me, it was the user interface that would enable users to design those cards.
How did you raise capital in the early days? And how much capital did you need early on if it was just you and your brother?
We didn't raise capital until we launched in 2009. We were able to raise capital because we had traction, because we had users, not because we were telling a story about a future when we would have a product and have users.
Once you launched the site, what were the first invitations you sent out, and how did you get traction initially?
Well, we never sent out invitations. So what happened was that there were people that knew what we were doing and asked us when they could use it. And so I had said to a friend that she could use it by September 30th, and she kept bugging me about using it. She kept bugging me, and finally I gave her a password, and I didn't think she'd be able to use the product or navigate through it. And then she gave me a call a few hours later, and she said, "So did you see what I made?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, I didn't see what you made." And she said, Well, can you just go on the site and log on and look at this invitation? Do you like the font color I chose? Do you like the font I chose? Do you like this? I thought it was really great that I chose that champagne bottle. And so she ended up sending that invitation to, 200 or 220 people. And honestly, there is no other way to describe how people started using Paperless Post other than that party.
What was the party for?
For her 22nd birthday.
One of your board members is Ram Shriram, who was an early investor in Google. How did you meet him?
We actually didn't meet Ram personally. He received an invitation or multiple invitations, and so he ended up going to the homepage of Paperless Post and reading about the About Us, and then maybe doing a little more Googling about us, and then wrote us a really warm email to our help email. We wrote him back, and we ended up having breakfast with him in New York City.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post, a web-based company that sends digital stationery. Paperless Post makes money by selling virtual coins for customizing its cards, and the company became profitable in 2010. Your chief operating officer, Lucy Grayson, helped you define the strategy and the business model for the company. How exactly was she helpful, and how do you make money?
I'd say she's been extremely helpful because she came in and helped us define who we were as a business, not just as a product. By her asking, we had to think really hard about how were we going to make money, and a lot of the options didn't fit with the product we'd created because having ads would have meant interjecting between two people's communication. My brother made the comment in a New York Times article that you would never have a flyer in a wedding invitation, so why would you have an ad on an online wedding invitation? And by April of 2009, we deployed a direct-to-consumer payment model. So I credit Lucy's involvement greatly with our self-definition as a business.
What were some stumbling blocks for you in the early days? You were fortunate in that you had a clear concept for the company and that you got traction pretty immediately. What was harder for you than you thought?
Every business that you create, there's also a lot of things that happen behind the scenes. We did learn along the way that there were a lot of other things a business required to succeed, such as email deliverability, which is one of the most detail-oriented and difficult sets of rules to learn. But James somehow became our in-house email deliverability expert
guru.
I remember Lucy saying early on when James was on a call about email deliverability, she was like, "Thank you for caring so much." And it was true. It's just out of pure care to learn something like email deliverability. And a lot of things that are not pretty go into creating an actual company.
Paperless Post offers a platform for design partners, ranging from large companies like Crane and Boatman Geller to boutique stationers. But it wasn't always that way. You didn't always have these outsourcing design partners. What were some of the first designs that you and your brother came up with?
One of the first ones was called Saint-Germain, and it was a cream rectangular invitation that had a gold bevel and rounded corners, and it just had a simple script font, and it was extremely formal and actually probably not financially viable to send with paper, but that and a few other invitations. One had a silk black ribbon, and it was sort of a shimmery silver paper stock. That was also very popular. Basically, we started out with this line that was extremely formal, and the interesting thing was that when users saw Paperless Post in the beginning, they just felt that that meant that they could use us for formal things, so they started using us for things like, you know, engagement parties or rehearsal dinners and later on actual weddings. And that wasn't really a core part of our plan, but it was amazing that that happened as a result of the type of cards that we originally started with.
You mentioned, you know, silk shimmery paper stock and liners. Now, we have to remember this is all virtual. What are some other designs you came up with?
One of the famous cards that we started out with was red, and it had black and white zebras jumping across the border, and it was based off of a wallpaper in an Italian restaurant in Midtown called Gino's, which I think is sadly now closed.
On Lexington Avenue in New York City. Paperless Post is effectively making stationery more affordable using a digital medium. For instance, you have a calligrapher named Bernard Meisner, who in the real world, his artwork and his actual cards are very expensive.
Bernard Meisner is one of the best calligraphers in the world. One of the wonderful things about having these design partners was that we could have people like Bernard Meisner, whose cards are normally at the mid-range, $6 per item, allow that type of design to be accessed by people who would not otherwise be able to afford to use it. And basically the reason for that is that we are only offering the design itself and the visual quality and not the cost of producing it in physical form.
When you mentioned $6 per item, do you mean per letter?
Yes.
Who is another artist, designer, that's offered on the site whom you particularly like?
Mr. Boddington is a line that is on Paperless Post. It's a sub-brand of Mr. Boddington, which is an offline artisanal stationer in New York City. The sub-brand is Mr. Boddington's Nephew, and it's been incredibly popular.
What does it look like?
It is colorful. It's witty. There's often hand-driven fonts on the cards, and it has its own very distinctive brand. There are colors that are regularly used, like pink and yellow and orange, and you know that it's Mr. Boddington when you see it. It's a really great sort of auger for the future of these design partnerships that we have, because we're actually being able to share a lot of revenue with these really talented designers and offer them a platform to get exposure to lots of visitors.
What was the last invitation you sent?
The last invitation I sent was a Chinese New Year invitation. It was for a dinner party that I'm having tonight. And it was on a card that looks like a gold coin, and it flips, and then there is sort of a witty joke, and then an invitation to dinner at 9.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Alexa Hirschfeld, co-founder of Paperless Post. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.